Well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm not very far away normally, but I don't come here as often as I should. So I'm going to talk about primordial black holes, and that is an idea that was explored in many different ways since it was first introduced by Zeldovich and Novikov many years ago. And primordial black holes can account for all dark matter, can also be part of dark matter. They can be seeds of supermassive black holes, which is an unsolved problem in astrophysics. And we can talk about that too. And they can contribute to LIGO signal if they are sufficient sizes. So I'll also talk about their effect on neutron stars, where they can, you know, by disruption of neutron stars, they can contribute to our process nucleosynthesis. So first, the formation scenarios. So we already had some discussion, and one very common class of models is when people look at the inflaton potential and modify it so that it would produce some overdensity on certain scales. So that requires a feature in the inflaton potential. And if those overdensities are big enough, then eventually when they come into the horizon, they can form a black hole of the size of that horizon. So that is the scenario that I will not discuss at all. So I will talk about something that is friendly with your favorite inflationary model. So I'm not going to touch the inflaton at all, right? You pick your favorite inflation model and we will work with that. Another class of models is very close to what I'm going to be talking about, and that is formation in matter-dominated phase. Brandon gave a talk this morning discussing one interesting model. So in that case, people look at the growth of structure in some matter-dominated phase, which may be intermittent, and they invoke that to produce the black holes. That was also discussed by Zeldovich and his students first, and there was a lot of work done since then. Matter-dominated epoch is an opportunity, but the main problem there, which Brandon emphasized, is that you have fluctuations that are not big enough, and you need some source of fluctuations. Right? And so they used some bluish spectrum of perturbations. We need something else. So I'll talk about a kind of matter that can come to dominate the universe, but instead of being made of zillion of particles, it will be matter made of very few particles, comparably, comparatively small number of particles. And therefore, the fluctuations will be large. These fluctuations will not come from the same source that produces perturbations that explain the structure. And all they will require is essentially just one scalar field in addition to your favorite inflaton. And I will also mention yet another scenario, which I think is interesting in the way that the mass function that produces is amenable to searches by my friends in Kavli, in Sister Kavli Institute in Japan, where I also have a job. And so we'll be using HSC in the next round to search for this tail of the mass function from this other class of models. So the constraints were already presented this morning, and the evolution of constraints, normally when people study the subject, they introduce more and more constraints. And here, over the last 5 years, there were fewer and fewer constraints because people, you know, there are some papers that were written earlier, finally got read by some other people and the constraints went away. And we can talk about that later. For example, there was one constraint here based on the neutron stars, which I will exploit later. And but that constraint was never, it was actually formed as a conditional statement. Yeah? So paper said, you know, they looked at neutron stars being destroyed by black holes and they said, okay, where can we get enough dark matter black holes to destroy neutron stars? Obviously in the galactic center. But whoops, there are no neutron stars in the galactic center. And an optimist can take it as a hint. But in any case, there is no constraints that you can set on that because we don't know of any neutron stars in the galactic center. We know of one magnetar, but it's too young to be affected by any black holes. So then they said, okay, what about dwarf spheroidals? And again, there's plenty of dark matter in the dwarf spheroidals, but there are no neutron stars there. And again, an optimist can take it as a hint, but there's no constraint. And so then this made a conditional statement. They said, if there is an overdensity by 3-4 orders of magnitude in globular clusters, then we can set a constraint, and there was a constraint around here. But globular clusters, they have plenty of neutron stars. They also have plenty of ordinary stars. And the mass, the velocity dispersions have been studied very carefully. And the upper limit on mass of dark matter limits it to factor 1.5 or 2 in terms of overdensity, and that is not good enough to set any limit. So that limit went away. The limit from HSC, which I will describe in more detail, was much more ambitious when it first came out as a preprint, then it became more modest when the paper got published, and recently when Stefano Profumo and Giotemo and friends analyzed it in more detail, it became even more modest. HSC uses lensing of stars in Andromeda galaxy to see if something makes a star brighter and dimmer. But that requires certain the way they run into a brick wall here is because of the finite size of the star. And they thought a typical star they could see would be just the size of the sun. But Stefano and friends pointed out that the brighter stars are actually easier to see. And most stars that they would see would be 10 times bigger, so the limit is small. So these limits were evolving in favor of opening up this nice big window for dark matter. And so what I have on the vertical axis is actually a fraction of dark matter in black holes, and this entire mass window is fair game. Okay? So this is a little more detail about the HSC search. HSC stands for Hyper Supreme CAM, and it's an instrument that actually is quite remarkable. It's 3 tons that is hanging over the mirror in the focal plane of Subaru telescope. Now, if somebody tells you that, okay, just take 3 tons of stuff and put it over a mirror, you'll probably get worried. But not if it is Subaru telescope, because it's built by the Japanese, and it will stay there where you put it in place, okay? So that's how they achieve this fantastic wide field of view. And then they take snapshots of the entire Andromeda galaxy in each snapshot, and they do it every 2 minutes, okay? And so by doing that, they can see if some star becomes brighter or dimmer, and that is their published limit, which eventually got reduced by one order of magnitude. And in addition to the limit, they also report a candidate event, which is of interest to this audience. So this is a very beautiful curve, consistent with, this is the theoretical expectation, and this is what you see, the star becomes brighter and dimmer, and this is precisely how you would observe a small black hole passing the line of sight. So this mass is a little bit too big to make up all dark matter. It would be sitting somewhere here. That's where the dent is in this curve, precisely because they have a candidate event. But this could be part of a broader distribution of a mass function that reaches out in this region and accounts for all dark matter. Okay? And so this is an interesting place to look for primordial black holes, for dark matter in the form of primordial black holes. Now, how do we make them? As I already promised, I will not modify the typical history of the universe, which starts with inflation, goes into radiation-dominated matter, except I may insert something in here. But I won't touch anything that you may like about inflation models or BBN or anything like that. And what I will insert there is some dynamics having to do with the scalar field. This could even be Higgs field. It's just that I need to know something about the potential which I don't know about the Higgs field, and that is how it behaves at large vacuum expectation values. But fortunately, supersymmetry, if it has anything to do with reality, produces many scalar fields. There's 120-something flat directions, and just about any of them satisfies what I need. And what I need is for the scalar field to have a relatively slow rise at large rev. So if the scalar field is not very steeply rising, if the potential is fairly shallow, then during inflation, it tends to jump around. Okay? It can just jump from its potential minimum to some random value because, you know, why not, right? It's the energy is not conserved, so why bother? Right? No one is under the impression that energy is conserved, right? Because if anybody ever, you know, raises that question, you can just give them a counter example. You take a very long chain, you attach it to a star very far away, and then the expansion of the universe generates energy forever. So obviously energy is not conserved.
Well, shallow, you mean, where's n squared pi squared?
Right, okay, so we'll come to that, okay. But just to finish with the energy, you know, the members of some other workshop here, which are more mathematically inclined, may attempt to derive energy conservation from some mathematical trick, the time translational invariance. And then what you should tell them is that time translational invariance is broken by the expansion of the universe. So they should not, you know, object to this field jumping around. And of course, in the sitter space, that field jumps around even more, right? Now, why does it matter how curved the potential is, how flat it is? So once the field jumps here, it has two ways of getting back, either by sliding down or by making another jump. The other jump is hopeless because it will never hit the target. It's random. But if the time scale for sliding down is faster than expansion of the universe, then the field will sort of instantaneously get back. And if not, then it will make other jumps. And on average, it will have the energy density per degree of freedom, which is set by the h parameter of the expanding universe to the fourth power. Okay. And people have calculated this by, you know, in different cases, and but basically the rule is that the average is about h. But then inflation is over, and the field has to come down. And what it does, it comes down by sliding down, but it doesn't necessarily remain homogeneous. Why not? There is an instability, which is similar to gravitational instability, except it is not gravitational. Right? So if you have a potential that rises slower than the second power of phi, for example, if it has minus phi cubed term, phi cubed is always minus in some direction. So then you can interpret that as an attractive force. It's an attractive self-interaction. Now, what happens if you have attractive force? You take a cloud of hydrogen, you let it interact with itself by gravity, it starts making stars. In the same way that homogeneous scalar field interacts with itself, attractive force creates an instability, it starts making lumps. Except this force is stronger than gravity. Okay? All right. So then you end up with lumps. And by the way, this is not how we first discovered this instability. We were studying Affleck-Dyne baryogenesis, where you have scalar fields with global charges and they evolve. And so what Misha Shaposhnikov and I did a while ago, we just took the homogeneous solution, added some exponentially growing perturbation, and looked for exponents that are positive, right? And then you get this band of unstable modes that tells you the sizes of these instabilities. And then people went ahead and simulated this numerically, and they confirmed that this indeed works. And you can also ask about the final state of that lump. What is that lump that you end with? That's in the case of a field that conserves U1 global number, it's a q-ball. And it's something that you get by minimizing energy under the constraint that there is a conserved global charge. You know, in supersymmetry, that could be baryon number. Right? So obviously, since charge has phi, phi equals zero is not going to give you conserved charge not equal zero. So the ground states has to be something else. And it's a lump of scalar field. And that lump, you know, is a stable, nice lump when this condition is minimized, when basically when there is some terms in the potential that makes it grow slower than phi x squared. Another interesting thing is that if the potential has this flat plateau, as you get in some models of supersymmetry breaking, for example, a flat direction in supersymmetry starts out at zero, and then gauge-mediated supersymmetry breaking makes it look like in that picture. So then the mass of each lump grows with the particle number, which could be baryon number, as the power 3/4, less than 1. And that means that mass per particle decreases as it becomes large. So this also means that, oops, that if you slice the condensate into pieces, the size differences will translate into mass fluctuations. Right? So if you have just this random process that produces some distribution of sizes, that actually results in the fluctuations of mass from one point to another. Okay? And so this is the process that I'm considering here. So some scalar field that was not the inflaton, wasn't planning to do anything important, suddenly finds itself out of equilibrium, you're sliding down that slope, and then fragmenting into lumps. And then, because it's lumps, it scales as 1 over scale factor cubed, not to the fourth, and it can come to dominate the universe temporarily. And then suddenly that field dominates, it's a matter-dominated epoch, dominated by the matter made of the lumps of the scalar field, until they decay. Well, so what? Okay, so that field, you know, comes to dominate and then disappears. However, while this is the case, it can, this matter is distributed with fluctuations which are large compared to what you would get from any other kinds of matter. Because if you have a zillion of particles, the fluctuations are suppressed by, you know, 1 over square root of m or something. But if you only have a few particles, and because, and their sizes distribution is telling you that there is also no trivial distribution of mass, then you just need to look for places where there is enough of a fluctuation to make a black hole. And even that isn't enough yet, because, okay, so you have an overdensity. Who cares? Solar system is an overdensity. It's not going to make a black hole anytime soon, right? However, if you find an overdensity that is sort of spherical enough and has velocities all pointing to the center, which is extremely unlikely, then, of course, it's going to make a black hole. So you just look for those, and it's hugely suppressed. Very small probability that you'll find such a configuration. Well, good for us, because at this time in the age of the universe, you only need a very tiny amount of matter to be dark matter. And that's the amount of dark matter you produce in the form of primordial black holes. And then when, so this field decays and everything becomes radiation again, until much later, black holes come to dominate and be dark matter.
What temperature are you talking about?
10 to the 6 to 10 to the 10 GeV.
What do you mean by hugely suppressed? Is there a number of roughly?
Oh, okay. So, right. So that depends. So depending on the size of the fluctuation, the, you know, I can't give you a percentage number, but so Zeldovich's student did a very careful analysis of precisely that in the context where it was, in my opinion, hopeless, because they were just considering matter with too many particles. Okay? Now, we stand on the shoulders of the giants, so we use that formalism to identify these big lumps. And you have to be very careful. So first of all, you can't wait for too long. Because so first you need a bunch of lumps to form a self-gravitating system. And then it needs to collapse to a black hole. Now, if it's virialized, it's not going to make a black hole. Because, you know, like solar system, right? And it's so you know, there's a window of opportunity there, and it better happen quickly, and there are all these inequalities that need to be satisfied, and that's how we end up with that population of primordial black holes. Now, here's an analogy. This is a picture I took in September at the site of a conference that I will shamelessly advertise at the end, and everyone's invited. And here you can see that if I assume a Poisson distribution, which, you know, most of you speak better French than I do, so this is a Poisson distribution, and the Poisson small Poisson fluctuations are produced when you have a large number of particles, okay? And now, however, sometimes if you have very large Poisson fluctuations, you know, the few giant particles will produce large fluctuations. This is my wife holding a relatively large Poisson fluctuation, okay? So, and I'm taking a picture, so. Right? So you can do the same thing with other lumps. Mustafa described very nicely these amazing lumps, the oscillons. They can also play this role. They are different. They have different properties, but can also make primordial black holes. Now, coming back to scalar fields from supersymmetry, there is something peculiar about the mass ranges, right? So the If you just consider very crudely, what would be the typical mass of a black hole coming from fragmentation of a flat direction in supersymmetry? Where would it, you know, where would it be on this mass line? So a scalar field like that fragments with the sizes that are not very different from the horizon size. It has to be, every fragment has to be smaller than the horizon size, but it's not going to be ridiculously small. It's going to be within an order of magnitude or so, okay? Because that instability is just waiting to happen as soon as causality allows it, it just goes, okay? So within the horizon, it starts working. So then you can estimate, okay, the horizon size, there's some fudge factors, et cetera. So from the scale of supersymmetry that one might expect, 100 TeV or so, one could place the mass of black holes in this range of 10 to the 20 something gram, which is exactly the range that is allowed by present constraints. Okay. So the actual abundance of black holes is highly model dependent, but the mass range, if you want to use one of the supersymmetry fields, then you are you're going into this window. And in that sense, primordial black holes is a generic dark matter candidate in supersymmetry, right? Because supersymmetry generically produces these flat directions, which like to fragment and make black holes. Now, if you take some other scalar fields, if you take some lighter scalar fields, you're going to make bigger black holes. And here is an example of you know, three mass curves which contribute 100%, 20%, and 0.1% of dark matter density at the mass ranges that would be relevant for dark matter, for explaining some Eros candidate event, and for LIGO. And I won't go through this comparison between the mechanisms that produce black holes using inflationary, you know, the inflaton potential, some features in the inflaton potential, and this scenario. But there is a number of differences in terms of well, everything, including spin. Ask me any questions. Okay, so now I want to mention yet another scenario, which is completely different, and it was invented by Deng and Vilenkin, although they didn't have this potential. This potential we invented because, you know, they wanted some potential, which they didn't specify, and we thought we had a nice candidate, and then we worked it out for this candidate. So what happens here is that the inflaton is rolling along this slow valley, and this is a Mexican hat with a dent, which is tilted. So this point is lower than this point, and there is some probability of tunneling. And then if that field tunnels, then locally, the a baby universe is born. And that baby universe has two choices. It can either expand or collapse. And if it is big enough, then it starts its own de Sitter expansion on the inside. And if it's not, then once the inflaton comes down below this level, it finds itself carrying too much energy density and it collapses. And so in both cases, these baby universes look like black holes to the outside observer, and the mass function you get in this case scales as 1 over square root of mass of the black hole. And that is an opportunity, because microlensing observations with HSC can't really go to the left, because first of all, the finite size of the source causes this nice microlensing curve to wash out, and second, even if you could bypass that, you quickly hit a limit that the Schwarzschild radius becomes smaller than the wavelengths of light. And then there is no microlensing then. Okay? And just to give you an idea, if this is, so this spectrum is consistent with 100% dark matter. And if this is the case, then there is just one primordial black hole flying through the solar system right now. And its Schwarzschild radius is much smaller than the wavelengths of visible light. Okay? So these are, that's the realities we're struggling with. However, if you have an extended mass function and it creates this little tail, this long tail actually, then the next observation of HSC may be able to see it. And so motivated by that and by the candidate event that they got, my colleagues at Kavli IPMU are going to schedule more observations on HSC and look for possible tail from this primordial black hole mass function accounting for all dark matter. So now let me tell you about something else. So I already mentioned that neutron stars are vulnerable to being destroyed by the black holes. And I told you about an unsuccessful attempt to set a limit. I also mentioned the missing pulsar problem that is sort of suggestive. We don't see neutron stars in places where there is a lot of dark matter. So can indeed the primordial black holes destroy neutron stars? Yes, they can. And they would, the way it happens is that a neutron star falls into a black hole falls into a neutron star. A black hole is very small initially. Then it wanders around the neutron star and starts eating it from the inside. And if the neutron star rotates fast enough to begin with, then as it is being eaten from the inside, it shrinks and begins to shed some of the neutron-rich material. And that is another way a population of dark matter black holes could manifest themselves. They could let us know by producing this neutron-rich material, which is essential for building heavy elements. Okay, so let me show you. So when we wrote this paper in PRL with George Fuller and Volodymyr Takhistov, then David Radici, who was then at Princeton, decided to simulate this numerically. And so you can see this is a preliminary result that he allowed me to show. And you can see that there is this there's this black hole that's wandering around and going back and forth. And then eventually it grows and becomes a solar mass black hole. But all this stuff that is that is in red and orange color, that is neutron-rich material. And that is being released. And the total amount of that material is a few percent of the solar mass. And so what happens to it is important in connection with our process nucleosynthesis. So our process nucleosynthesis is important for making gold and platinum and uranium, all the important elements, okay? So you know that the lightest elements were built in the Big Bang. The rest of the elements up to iron were made in stars. But then going past iron is difficult. Iron is very stable. Yeah, it's fine. We can add a neutron or proton. But first, we have to stay on the stability line. So this is neutron number, proton number. If you go in this direction, Coulomb repulsion will break up the nucleus. If you go in this direction, neutrons will start decaying. So you better stay close to this line if you want to have your nuclei stable. And then to get to this point, you would have to have more elements with lower numbers. So you've never produced these majestic peaks, okay? And you would never have enough gold. Not an uncommon problem. And so this is a, but this exact line is very easily reproduced. If you start with neutron-rich matter anywhere here, and it doesn't really matter where. So you start with some neutron-rich matter and you let the neutrons get together and stick together, and they don't just do 2 to 2 or 2 to 1, right? They just do 10 into 1, okay, when the neutron density is high. And they drift, they drift towards the islands of stability, which are represented by these peaks, okay? And people wondered for a long time whether it is, where the site is. For example, people thought supernovae explosions would be the site of the R-process nucleosynthesis. But that doesn't work because there are actually equal numbers of neutrinos and antineutrinos. And even if you get some neutrons out of the proto-neutron star, you fry them with by exposing them to equal numbers of neutrinos and antineutrinos. Now, the best candidate we know is neutron star mergers. And it seems to be consistent, but there's no proof that all nucleosynthesis takes place there. And we can talk about that later and about some discrepancies in the simplest models, which can be rectified with three-zone models, but then you don't really see the production of the heaviest elements. So in the question session, I can talk about that if you want.
Are those error bars or just behavior?
Those are error bars, yes. Okay. Another interesting observation is that among the other 10 ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, only one is rich in the R process enriched materials, right? So all these heavy elements are present in one dwarf spheroidal galaxy and not in the others. So the dwarf spheroidal galaxies are like humans. Yeah, one has all the gold and the rest of them have nothing, okay? And that again is consistent with a rare event and is consistent with the rates at which the dark matter black holes would be destroying the neutron star. In fact, if you look at that window again, what you need is if you are anywhere above this line, then within astrophysical uncertainties, you can explain up to all our process with just the destruction of neutron stars. And below this line, you can't, okay? But you can explain part of it. Another interesting effect is that these blobs of neutron-rich matter heat up by beta decays to temperatures about half an MeV, and they release relatively cold positrons through the surface. And these positrons are cold enough to then annihilate almost at rest and explain the observed 511 keV line from the galactic center. And that is, the rates are consistent within the astrophysical uncertainties, but the arrows are big, and the arrows are in the exponent. Another thing would happen is that if you take a neutron star and squeeze it into a black hole, you just take a big magnet, you massage it on the time scale of milliseconds, you're going to have a millisecond time scale burst of radio waves, right? So some of the fast radio bursts can be telling us about this. And one way, yet another way to see these events is to find the end result of that a neutron star genocide, because the black holes of any size would produce one solar mass black holes after eating a neutron star. So if gravitational waves observations or some other observations discover population of 1-2 solar mass black holes, that would be a smoking gun for primordial black holes because there are no astrophysical processes that would make black holes that small. And so now I will conclude perfectly on time and mention yet another signature, which I didn't have time to discuss. But basically, if you see a kilonova event without a gravitational wave counterpart, that would be an indication that the neutron stars have not merged, that something else destroyed a neutron star and released neutron-rich material, and that something else is consistent with the black hole eating the neutron star from the inside. Because in this case, the whole process is too close to spherically symmetric, and you don't get a significant amount of gravitational waves emitted in the process. Okay? Well, thank you very much.
Hi, thanks for the talk. So I have a question regarding the first part of the talk.
Okay.
You said that you need a small number of particles so that you have sort of rare big fluctuations.
Right.
And then you mentioned supersymmetry.
Right.
So supersymmetry, in a lot of times, it gives you a bunch of scalar fields. You just need one of them, right? So
exactly.
you want one of them to be light and the other ones to somehow be very heavy to
right.
not be.
Or they don't fragment because of okay. some other reason. Or they fragment at the wrong time. Right? Because what they need to do, they need to fragment when their energy density is not too small compared to radiation. Right? Then they come out and come to dominate. Otherwise, they just... Right.
So it's somewhat easy to
right.
tune most of them away and keep
right.
like a couple.
Right. That's right. That's right.
So again, in the fragmentation scenario, if I wanted to make you've done the analytical estimates in your papers. What is the main source of uncertainty, you think, in predicting the final, say, the final, how much of the how many black holes there are, for example.
Very good question.
What is the key?
Very good question. So we're working in detail, very far in detail of the distribution, which we don't know. Right? So, I mean, we assumed Poisson because no one's complaining, but...
I would.
And if anyone complains, I say, okay, you go calculate it. Okay? Right? So that, I mean, and I actually... So I am confident about the mass scale that I get from supersymmetry. I'm not confident at all about the overall normalization of that mass function. And, you know, if you tell me that I made a mistake in the exponent and it's, you know, an order of magnitude higher or an order of magnitude lower, I'll say, sure, I didn't know the distribution. Now, I know that you know something about the distribution. The problem is that to get a reliable estimate, one would want to have a numerical simulation, but no numerical simulation can go to probabilities that small. No one has a numerical simulation big enough to see these very tiny probabilities. If you have a way of somehow extrapolating the distribution, which I think you might, then you could probably start with a simulation which is already close enough to that unlikely configuration, and then you can get the answer.
But you, just to continue, so, but it is the initial, just to understand correctly, it is the initial distribution that is a key source of uncertainty, not the small evolution that you want for things to collapse immediately, right? You mentioned.
Right, okay. Right.
I think that's the main.
That's right.
Just to see if I understood following this question. So is it fair to say that we don't really know if they form or not?
No. Okay, so we know they form, and we can estimate the abundance for something that seems reasonable, such as Poisson distribution. So we are working very far in the exponential tail of the distribution, looking for configurations that are overdense, self-gravitating, and spherical enough to actually just fall into a black hole. Okay, and so there's a small probability, but we have a lot of we have a lot of numbers to waste. We're not worried about the small probability. In fact, we want the small probability at that early time. Now, the details of that mass function have to do with the details of the distribution. If the distribution is this nice exponential, has this tail like Poisson, then everything is under control. If there is some correction to that, then there will be a correction to that.
So let me put it in another way. So is it an uncertainty of 10 orders of magnitude or one order of magnitude?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so because, most distributions I encounter look like Poisson. Until you really look with the magnifying glass.
But I think the argument you're making, right, that there is at least the fact that there is a negative correlation at small scales, just because there is a.
Since you mentioned negative correlation, that's for oscillons.
I think. When they form, it should be also true for cubels.
No, because if you have two cubels that are about to overlap, they will overlap.
No, but
When
they form, there's an instability that forms them, right?
Yeah.
And if there's an instability that forms them, that means there's a characteristic K nonlinear at which they form. Yeah. So they will form at some separation.
No.
They can't form on top of each other.
No, they can't form on top of each other. If that happens, they will merge very quickly to minimize the energy. Because if the mass is proportional, that's the difference with the epsilon case, right? So if the mass is proportional to the power 3/4 of the particle number, there's a huge amount of energy to be gained by merging two nearby solitons into one.
I think that's why I was asking that initial formation.
Mm-hmm.
It would still, because of a particular instability at a characteristic wave number, that means they form at a separation initially. You might be, I have nothing to argue about whether they merge together later or not, but the initial formation must be at some, they don't form in a Poisson way, right? There has to be a characteristic scale of separation as they form.
Well, so, right, but then, okay, so what we're interested in is the million of cubels that will find themselves inside their common Schwarzschild radius. Okay? So they will not be at the distances that are comparable to their radii. So that is the part of the distribution that I want to know.
So that's a later distribution.
Well, it's not necessarily later. It's a bigger distribution, yeah. On the scales that are large compared to the radius.
So in the first part of your talk, you said that your results are fairly independent of the underlying model of inflation.
Right.
And I mostly agree with you on that, but there must be some constraint on the scale of inflation,
yeah,
like with which or for which your results are.
Yeah, so,
like
so
there
for
must
example,
be some consistency.
Yeah, yeah, of course, of course.
So
yeah,
I'm just wondering what that scale
yeah, yeah,
is.
Yeah, so if we use supersymmetry, you know, if we use supersymmetry, then you know we want 100 TeV to be the scale below the reheating temperature, and so yes, there are some. There are some.
So can you give me a number, either on
scale? I think that we use the reheat temperature of 10 to the 6 GeV or something like that for models that were for this model that goes into this A region.
Right. So the Hubble scale can actually be smaller than 1 GeV,
yeah,
if you wish.
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
We had a question earlier on there. Not anymore. Not anymore.
Hello, I'm Kovian Zanov, Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics, Garching, Germany. I have a question which is related to the scale of inflation and the formation of Q-balls. So basically, you form your Q-balls from, I guess, a complex scalar field which is rotating in a complex phi plane, right? And I'm just wondering, how do you get the, you know, the condensate to rotate in a complex?
Yeah, very good question.
Yeah, because I mean, inflation kind of favors radial trajectories, as we have discussed with Dan recently.
Right.
Slow roll, you know, trajectories are normally along the, you know, radial direction.
Right. That's right. So this is a story of Affleck-Dan baryogenesis, actually. So you have a potential which extends very far, and this is a flat direction, and this is one of the flat directions that carries a baryon number. So I don't know, it can be QQQ, or you know, there are several different directions that carry baryon number. Okay? So there is a U1 baryonic which is exactly preserved here at the vacuum. Okay. However, at large Vs, baryon number is supposed to be broken by you know, quantum gravity, by higher dimension operators, by whatever. Okay. And so if you start at a very large Vf, here U1 symmetry is broken. So then let's look at the real phi, imaginary phi plane. So the field starts out at a very large VF, and it has no reason why it should initially point towards the center, right? So it just starts out at some random direction. And then it just spirals in as the universe expands, then the magnitude of the field spirals in because the energy density goes down, right, by the expansion of the universe. But then, somewhere close to the origin, there is a domain where baryon number becomes a very good symmetry, okay? And so from that point on, the U1 charge of this condensate is fixed, because at that VF, there is no high dimension operators that break baryon number. And so from that point on, we can just look at what happens. And that is how Affleck and Dine envisioned creating matter-antimatter symmetry in theories with supersymmetry.
Doesn't the red circle become more and more eccentric? Because as you expand, the total number is conserved, but then again, the concentration decreases.
The circle is just the VEV below which I don't care about higher dimension operators breaking the baryon.
Right, but if this happens during the sitter, very quickly?
No, all of this happens after the sitter.
Okay, yeah.
Right?
Okay.
So during the sitter, the field is just sitting here. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's just sitting and waiting opportunity. Not jumping around. But basically one patch with a certain value gets expanded to a very large value, and you can just consider it constant.
Okay. Thank you.
Peter Edsett at University of Illinois. So the question I had was about the second mechanism, and you showed these mass functions which are paired to extend to really small primordial black hole. I was just wondering those have to be cut off, right? Because we cannot have black holes that evaporate, even if they mess up the CMB. And then so in your picture, it just seemed like this thing was piercing this evaporation constraint, and I was sort of just curious as to
right. So
what cut that off.
So let me see. What I had in that picture.
Yeah, this plot. So the one on the left, for example.
Right. So this is probably misleading because this is just the band okay. So this band actually ends here. So for example, a mass function like this would contain 100% of black holes. This is more of an example. This is a better example. So this solid green mass function corresponds to 100% dark matter, and it is discoverable despite this apparent gap. Well, Tommy explained to the world how to deal with how to translate differential constraints into integral constraints, something that cosmic ray people knew for years, but we didn't know, right? And so this reach for differential constraints actually is sufficient to discover this mass function. Okay. So here it's not normalized. This is just a slope that is consistent with one candidate event at HSC. Right. So that candidate event doesn't care whether you have 100% of dark matter or 150% dark matter or 90% of dark matter, right? So this is just a slope for which the tail of the mass function can explain the one candidate event that HSC saw in its initial observation.
So Alex, that can't be right, because as you explained, there are finite-sized source effects, so certainly that band ends at some point on the left.
Right. So it's the constraint,
so
that, right.
It's just inconsistency of
sort of. No, this is just a line. So basically, this line can be cut off here.
Yeah.
This is just a slope.
It's just a slope meaning that it's just a flux of these objects that you
right.
have to go in front of stars. But if these objects are too light, they don't do anything. You don't observe anything.
No, this is done already for 10 solar mass stars in Andromeda, convolved with the HSC acceptance.
Yeah, still, 10 to the negative 14, way smaller.
Right. So that's, okay. So again, this slope is consistent with discovering one black hole at 10 to the minus 7 solar mass.
This slope.
Yes. So the question is, okay. Right, so if your acceptance is only 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8 solar masses,
yes.
Then you have no knowledge of what happens at 10 to the minus 14. Question, what should be the slope of the mass function, regardless of what it does at small masses, in order for you to explain one event at 10 to the, where they saw it, and not to see anything else? And so this slope is consistent with that observation.
Okay, but so would also be a constant.
Right. So this is we assume that it's 1 over square root of m, that's the model, and then we normalize it, okay? And so and the interesting thing is that it didn't have to work out that way, right? For example, if they observed something here, then for any event here, with this slope, you would expect to see 10 events at smaller mass.
Sorry, I had forgotten that in your model you had a very definite prediction.
Yes,
of the slope.
Yes, this thing. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, sorry. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, so I would like to ask more about this model. So probably in the previous slide, so the origin is supposed to be the true minimum, or, I saw that if it is a multiple
right.
scenario,
so,
it's going to be new created.
So the idea is that while the inflaton is running in the potential,
yeah.
it tunnels to some false vacuum at a constant rate or almost constant rate.
But it doesn't continue nucleating up to the B until it's going to be settled down.
Well, the way tunneling happens is that it happens in one finite size volume. And the rest of the universe keeps doing what it's doing. Okay? And then it happens in some other finite size volume. So then you count how many of different sizes you get, taking into account the expansion of the universe and the expansion of these bubbles. These bubbles also expand, okay? But they don't expand as fast as the rest of the space, because they only expand at the speed of light. And in the sitter, you can, points move away faster than the speed of light if they're far enough. So then you count how many of which size. And that counting gives you the 1 over square root of m tail, okay? And that gives you, the slope of this line or the slope of this line.
Yeah, that part is fine, but what I'm asking is if the origin in that figure is a true minimum, then I understand.
No. So this is a Mexican hat with a dent, so this is higher than this. Right?
Okay. I'm sorry.
So if you put that hat flat, then this point would have a positive energy density.
Okay, that's why.
And then you tilt it a little bit.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, that's
So also, I think related to the last two questions, also Peter's. So from the physics of this picture,
what gives you the cutoff scale on the left? Like, can you compute where the triangle is?
Right. Right, so the cutoff scale on the left is just the size of the bounds when you make tunneling. The cutoff scale on the right also exists, but it's too big. We don't have to talk about it. Yeah.
So there is a calculable cutoff scale for
yes.
the triangle.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Any last questions? If not, let's thank Alex again.
Oh, thank you.